This is the Lean Construction Blogs podcast, a podcast dedicated to stories, case studies, and lessons learned of applying lean construction from around the world. Join Dick Beyer as he interviews industry leaders, lean construction practitioners, and subject matter experts to help you improve the built environment in general and your design and construction projects in particular. Advance your lean journey and bring your continuous improvement efforts to the next level. Let's get started.
Good day, everybody. It's Dick Beyer with the podcast from the Lean Construction Blog. Thanks so much for joining us. Today, I'm happy to say that I have a colleague and a friend who is in the pantheon of people in our community who have done extraordinary things. Howard Ashcraft has crafted, no pun intended, early versions of the IPD. He's been involved in the Integrated Project Delivery Movement for a very long time, at the same time winning Construction Litigator of the Year in California. He is the head of his firm practice in IPD and built a team around him, which is something that we've all tried to do. He is teaching or has taught at Stanford, has taught at the Said School of Project Management at Oxford with Ben Flyberg. I'm not sure that there's an award that Howard hasn't won except for the Academy Award. Last year, he was presented, he and his team were presented with the Pioneer Award from LCI, which is really the Academy Award of our industry. So welcome, Howard. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dick. I'm happy to be here.
That's fantastic. So did I miss any awards or any recognition?
There's probably something my mother would have appreciated somewhere back there. But no, I think you got all or more than we needed to talk about.
That's fantastic. I'd love to get into your father flying for Cuban Airlines and all the rest of that stuff, but we'll save that for another day. Speaking of that, segueing right into your education and background, we'd love to start off the podcast with, tell us where you're from and where you grew up and a little bit about your education.
Yeah, that you got part of it there in terms of my father was with Pan American in most of his career. And so we moved around. I was the equivalent of an Army brat, only not an Army brat, and moved around, went to high school in Germany, graduated from there, then went to Stanford in great part because I had never been there and it sounded cool. So, you know, the decisions you make at that age turned out to be a good one. And I showed up there and very quickly I was starting off in actually a little bit of architecture and engineering and got seduced into biology.
Wow.
Which is what I ended up graduating in great part because there was a professor who sounded like he came off of PBS or BBC and it was fascinating. And so there I was. It was all about systems, which when right. We come back to it is actually what I mostly I'm interested in. So from there, after I graduated, I realized I was fairly good at computer science, for which there were no jobs at the time, and genetics, for which there were also no jobs at the time, other than academia. And so I ended up taking the LSAT and ended up going to law school, which was kind of my next step, where I also tended to look at law as a system. And from then, I did what most people do is I tried to get a job and ended up working for a firm. And somewhat accidentally, other than the fact that my wife was working at the firm at the time, and I said, I've got an offer. Several people want me to work for them. What should I do? And she said, work for the construction section. And after that, all is history. Because once I was in there, it turned out it's exactly what I wanted to do. And it's what I have done since 1979.
Wow, that's fantastic. It's really interesting. Of the three lawyers I know that have made a splash in our business, including myself, you're the one that stayed as a lawyer. But Will Ligtig started off as an anthropologist for very much that idea around systems that you were working on. I was an American historian, very much around the idea of how did things go so wrong on a regular basis. And we've all ended up bringing, not an engineering background to our work, which I think is fascinating because most of the people we deal with on a regular basis are engineers or architects or people in construction management who have a kind of engineering degree. So it's fascinating that that's where we gravitate to, and especially in construction.
Yeah, I think that is interesting. I was actually thinking about that same thing because I still maintain a legal practice, though I don't really do litigation anymore. Pretty much gone. But I still work at a law firm, still operate out of that context, and still am heavily involved with some of the legal side of things. But I think that the systems focus at looking at how things operate, while it's not a particularly lawyer thing, a lot of lawyers don't do that, but it is actually one of the ways you can look at law. And so that kind of sucked me in. And I did also have a natural science background. So I took a little engineering, a little architecture, a little of this, a little of that. Turned out to be a very good background for what I ended up doing.
Yeah, I think I think we underestimate the value of a liberal arts education, an education that challenges you in many disciplines. We tend to focus our kids and our grandkids on, you know, we'll get out of school and get a job, and that's I'm not sure that's the better part of the bargain these days. So you became a lawyer and you started working in construction. How did you get hooked up with the AIA and the integrated project delivery mode, almost 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, it's been a while. What actually happened was I was a failed programmer, and so I was writing a number of programs to try to and applications that I thought would be possible, be useful, and I happened to be going through the transition in programming from what was called linear programming to object-oriented programming. And I started reading about this stuff called object-oriented CAD, and it was a precursor to BIM. And I started getting very interested in how that technology worked and recognizing some of the things I'd already gone through in the transition in programming. I realized that a lot of the things that we said we could do with this new software, I had just spent 17 to 20 years telling people not to do. In other words, the software worked best and was capable of doing the things we wanted to if we opened up communication amongst all the parties, tightly integrated them, and operated essentially as a virtual organization with the communication system, with the being object-oriented CAD and BIM. And so I kind of stopped and thought, oops. We've been telling people to stay in their silos for the last 20 years or longer, because that was the safe thing to do. And I started saying, well, there's no point trying to fight technology, we'll always win. if we're going to go and use this technology fully, how would you design a project delivery system that made this happen? And that got me hooked into the AIA California Council group that was also starting to focus on project delivery. And it's very interesting to me that a couple of things were happening at the same time. At Stanford, they were working on virtual design and construction. Right. At the Lean Construction Institute and folks who connected that were focusing on productivity and reducing waste in a very high-level way. And at the AICC, we were starting to look at how do you actually get innovation, creativity, and high performance and use of technology. And we all ended up with almost exactly the same formula. Hmm. And so over a period of time, what were three separate strands have actually become fully intertwined, and modern IPD actually draws from all of them.
Right.
All those strands in that. But that was my entry point, was actually technology. But I pretty quickly realized that if it was only technology, we could have bought our way out of it. So it was more than just buying software. It was changing the basic systems in order to make it operate.
Well, what's interesting is that the technology that has come along the the P6s of the world and the different automation systems to help you automate scheduling or estimation have actually kind of landed technology in the laps of people who don't necessarily understand how to use it effectively. And although this the technology works really well, it doesn't help us much. And that's one of those kind of interfaces between people and systems that if you're automating a system through technology, you have to be able to get the right input in there, right? And the right outputs, and you have to be able to do it in real time. And that's, I think, one of the interesting things about our system in construction is that the more technology we get, the worse we get at delivering projects.
Well, I think a lot of it is also is you have to understand what the technology can do, and not think that it is a savior. I think one of the interesting things, and I've, by the way, I've fallen into this, I'm not throwing stones at other people. I've made all of these mistakes. And
I'm moi aussi, as we say up here in Canada.
Early on, I was also sort of fascinated by CPM and how it worked, and spent a lot of time studying it. And it was only later that I started going to the fundamental question of what's the point of a highly sophisticated database that plans things out into, and the worst situation I've seen is somebody who actually tried to break a major project down into 15-minute increments, which meant if you went to the bathroom, you had you pushed the critical path. What's the point of doing that if you can't actually, if you're incapable of predicting the future? And I think one of the things that was great about the last planner system is that it focused on what we can actually predict and not getting to a level of detail that was in fact fanciful.
Yeah, I think that the what's interesting about that, because you had talked about LTI concentrating on productivity, but the last planner system really concentrates on reliability, even over productivity, which has the beneficial outcome of increasing productivity. Because if you're able to do the work that you're supposed to do, then that increases your productivity. But it was really about the reliability of your plan, and I think that's one of the things that sets it apart, is that at least it's more reliable. At least you can plan better, and as a consequence, you can do all these other things. But I'm also getting to the point in time where, because I'm integrating all of these resources in my own mind, that I've gotten to the kind of biomimicry system understanding that I think you probably got to early on. That unless all of these things like tact time and the last planner system, they're all great, but they have to work as part of an overall system. And each one of them doesn't work on its own, much like the silos don't work very well on their own. And I think that's the interesting thing where we're trying to incorporate into projects and get owners to be thinking about is that overall system. How do you create a system, both a culture that allows that system to operate, a contract that is a platform for that system, and then a system that actually functions well?
Yeah, you're actually using system a little more broadly than I do, but incorporating the things they think are left out in terms of when I talk about I'll talk about structure when I'm setting things up, and I'm focusing on everything from it's a systems view of how you actually execute a project. And so it can go right back into how it's financed, all kinds of things that actually influence. But when you when you start pulling back and starting looking at structure,
right,
and saying, well, this is the answer. We have to get the structure right. And the answer is, yes, we do. But the word you used a moment ago is completely left out of that structural discussion, which is culture. And you can say culture or behavioral aspects, or there's a couple of different ways to phrase that. But even if you got the perfect contract, the perfect financing, the perfect organization, the perfect communication system, if you didn't actually have the ability for high performance teams to work well together, if you didn't develop the cultural basis for that to happen, you've improved things, but you haven't solved the problem. And so I think you have to take a much more holistic view of what it takes to make a project successful. And that doesn't denigrate any of the approaches, whether it's structural, whether it's, you know, whatever approach you want to take, but they're only part of the question. Some years ago, I was asked to do a presentation on IPD, a complete presentation on IPD in less than 5 minutes. And my response was I took a Pelican case,
right,
put it up on the dais. I opened it up so people couldn't see what's in, and I pulled out a martini glass. And I said, this is structure, but it's not a cocktail.
Right. You need,
and then I started pouring in other ingredients and such and saying what those ingredients were. And I said, what's the last thing we all know about drinking? And someone said, you never drink alone. And I said, yes, collaboration. And I started handing out martinis. And that was my entire IPD discussion. The point being that any one of those pieces, each one of those pieces was important, but none of them were a cocktail.
Wow. That's a great story. I can hardly get my name out in 5 minutes, much less talk about the context of the stuff that I believe in. So well done, young man. So we're talking about culture and we're talking about, and we both have tremendous experience in how the court system works and how the law is developed. And actually what attracted me to contracts and to the law was the history of the common law and the way that the common law developed amongst people as opposed to impositions on people. It just developed from the stories of the villages and the shires and the guy whose shaft was broken and he went down to get it fixed. And should he be awarded compensation for the time his shop was shut down? Or should he just be awarded compensation for the shaft? I mean, those kinds of things really resonated with me as stories that you can build a culture and a tradition around. So how does the contract play a part in assisting us develop and in developing that cultural piece, or does it?
Well, I think it does, and it does in some direct ways, ways I would describe as causative, and it also in some that I'd call correlative. In the causative aspect, if you stop and think, and you talked about the common law, but you also have to look at the 1963 work that was done on relational contracting and looked at actually the, in most instances, a lot of the things lawyers look at are the exceptions, not the rules. And the rules are actually operating in a relational mode. And when you start looking at the contract, if you make some basic changes, everybody has a chunk of the profit pool and they're all in it together. Well, now they actually have to work together in order to optimize their outcome instead of the traditional way where we have lots of different contracts, each of which are individual. You create a validation process built into the contract that has to happen in order for it to go forward. The parties have to agree on what the goals are. They have to agree on how they're more or less going to execute those goals. You start developing a part of the relationship and the culture inside the contract. Then you basically say, oh, by the way, you can't sue each other, so you can't blame each other if something goes wrong. So you've tied their profit together. They can't blame each other. They develop their goals together, and they jointly manage the project. That's not doesn't guarantee a good outcome, but you've now moved a long way towards creating a system that is highly based on the relationship of the parties, but it's built into the contract. If you don't have that, you can do it extrinsically, some of this. But our experience, and backed up by the work at the University of Minnesota, Cheng's work, is that you actually get a deeper and more complete operation of the system if in fact it's built in structurally, that's sort of like the causative piece. And right. That's how you try to design a relational contract. The correlative piece is, if someone tells you they're unwilling to make any change, and they won't change their procurement system, they won't change their contract system, they won't change anything else, why would you expect that they're going to change to a high performance system?
Right.
And what I find is that the teams say, okay, we will try something new, are much more likely to then actually execute something new than the team says, we can't change anything, but we're just going to tweak. And one of those things that I've, you know, read a lot of the research for the last 40 years is that tweaking doesn't work. You have to fundamentally change if you want fundamentally different outcomes. And people like tweaking because it feels comfortable, but it's not very effective.
Yeah, I think you're certainly onto something. Obviously, you know, I keep my relational contracting Bible by my bed at night, and Ian McNeil is one of my all-time favorites, and I've been trying to. But he really completely reconstructed contracts from the way that you and I learned the ROTA in law school, from offer, acceptance, consideration, legality, and capability, to exchange and reciprocity, which are big concepts really for that haven't had much traction in the contract industry, except really in the IPD and perhaps maybe in the alliancing models, some of these very more collaborative models. But you said something really interesting, and I think this is the struggle as I get onto projects, that we incentivize through the risk reward. Everybody rises and sinks at the same time. But those are institutions, those are firms, those are the IPD parties. And it's not easy to necessarily get that mindset into the guy that's hanging the drywall, or the guy who's drafting up the shop for the electrical equipment and the switchgear, that getting the people motivated at that level of almost Daniel Pink intrinsic motivation on the project requires some structural changes from those institutions. So the institutions are motivated by the contractual thing, but how do we get those institutions to say to their people, you know, you're empowered to do the last planner system and not the P6 or the Microsoft project or whatever the software happens to be. How do we move that knob?
Well, I think there's two things. One of which, by the way, is creating the space with the institutions by the shared pain, shared gain, that gets the institution bought in, and to some degree senior leadership. Without getting that, you have a hard time getting down to the lower levels. So you've cleared one hurdle by doing that, but those people aren't swinging hammers,
right?
And so there are a couple of things that need to happen. I mean, I don't think that money is the solution for this next step. But it really is one of making, first having a very strong continuous onboarding system, developing a project culture separate and apart from a firm culture, getting people to think of themselves as I'm part of this project. An example on a project that I was thinking about is that entertainment facility, giving all the workers tickets for them, for their family, for one of the very first concerts, so they could show people what they did. So they have ownership in the building itself. So there's a really interesting study. It actually has to do, I'll have to dig it up sometime, but I read it, and it has to do with offshore call centers. And they found that when they brought people into work for the call center, which is about as boring a job as you can think, and they they said, okay, here's HR, go to HR, go do this, go do that, go to training and sit down at your desk and do your call center work. People lasted, I forgot, I'm making this up in terms of the numbers now, but lasted like 9 months and then they were gone. If they asked, if in onboarding they asked, they said, here is why this call center is important and here is the service it provides to people. Can you tell us how you are able to actually help us do that better? What attributes do you bring that you think would allow you to actually serve this goal? And people stayed like 2 years who were asked. It was, so there was a very substantial increase. And so one of those things I think is you have to create a personal connection between the project and the people executing the project. And you also have to build a lot of the culture in terms of psychological safety and all the other things we talk about.
Right.
To make people feel like they are part, but you have to make people part of the project and have them feel like it is theirs. And it is a goal worth, it's easy to do in healthcare. It's harder to do in a tilt-up warehouse.
Yeah. I remember I was working at the University of Iowa Children's Hospital, and we were having trouble with the drywallers. They had just been, like, the local firms had just been bought by some national drywaller, and it was just hard to get drywallers, you know, in there. So we stopped the partnering session. We took every week that we figured out how to get over to the NICU the next day, and we took folks to the NICU in this that had been set up in the standard hospital, and it was going to be, you know, five times as large as that. And the only NICU that was close other than this kind of temporary one was in Des Moines, which was, you know, 200 miles away. And it was, think about your wife or your kids or whoever who goes into this NICU. You're 200 miles away from this kind of service if you don't finish that hospital. And it was just that simple of a 2-hour, 3-hour visit that just increased productivity in drywall almost immediately. And it lasted about 3 months, but then it tapered off because the effect of those connections sometimes wears off. So I think it's important to maintain those connections throughout the project, but you're absolutely right. You've got to find ways to get people to connect to a tilt-up workshop
even if you don't have a grand reason. One of the things we found is you can change this industry if you operate differently. And we focus in a lot of teams when they're doing charters, one of the things that they'll come up with is they want to change the industry. And we did a research project and got some data back, which I've published. But what I didn't publish was some of the comments. And the comment that I thought was most stuck near and dear to my heart is someone who said, after having done an IPD project, everything else feels like punishment.
Right.
And the making this something you want to do, you'd want your children to do, that you think is actually both useful and fun, I think that's something we have to do. And everyone talks about the difficulty of getting good labor.
Right.
If you make it a prison, you're not going to get good labor.
Correct. And it's hard enough. I mean, in Canada, people are working until I think the go home buzzer happens at about 20 below centigrade. And that's a little chilly to be out there, you know, hanging steel or tying rebar or all the things that people do that is really tremendously difficult. I always recoil against people who say, oh yeah, IPD is just that kumbaya. No, this is a hard business. It's a demanding business that requires hard physical labor. And it requires people that are really committed to it. And you see them on projects. I mean, I'm on projects all the time and you see people who really love their work. But it's kind of trying to make that trying to get that infection around making a difference and going home every day, Daniel Pink talks about mastery and being able to look at what you've done. Teresa Mirabel talks about being able to look at something you've done that day and go home satisfied that you actually made a difference. in life. And those kinds of things, I think, are so important. Some of the metrics that we try to create enable people to kind of calculate, how did you feel today about the stuff that you were doing and what did you get done? Let me just switch topics a little bit. And I want to talk about the contract and stuff, but I think it's so much more interesting to talk to you about structure and those kinds of things. Cause you've got the contract and you've been really successful at it, but we have five basic parts or four basic parts to our equation here, to our poker table. We've got the owner, we've got the design side, we've got the contractors who are kind of the managers, and then we have the trades. And I think each of them has obviously they have different roles to play, but each of them has a different wall that they have to get across in order to be fully open to doing a collaborative contract, whether it's, IPD and any of the different versions out there, or even alliancing, or what's happening in progressive design build, where we're trying to get an IPD like validation period up front before they get to the GMP. So with respect to the owners, let's get to the owners last. With respect to designers, what do you think the challenges are, and what do they have to do to be able to not only, survive in this model, but to thrive in this model?
It's difficult for a lot of designers because their business model is their traditional business model. By the way, their traditional model is going to get so upset by AI, they've got to figure out a better way.
I know.
If they don't start getting paid on value, the widgets are going away. And they traditionally make their money on widgets, not on ideas. So their business model is such that they have a hard time, and they're also under very, they've got a couple things going against them: low margins, bad business model. They are also hammered by their E&O carriers to be risk averse and to be extremely risk averse. And in most instances, in the early days of design build, a long, long time ago, I remember being in an AIE meeting, and it was extolling the advantages of design build, and everyone was saying, the master builder is back, and we are the master builders. We, the architects, will lead everyone out of the darkness. And somebody said something about, well, okay, that means you have to accept responsibility for cost and schedule. And they went, oh, we can't do that. And a contractor in the back said, I will. And that was the end of the story about design build, folks.
Wow.
At that point in time, the architects lost the ability. I mean, there is design-led design build, but there's not a lot of it.
Right.
So you've really got to be in a position where you can recognize what real risk is, that you can have a better business model, and that your traditional processes are you're not going to make the money off the widgets. We're going to turn the widgets over to somebody else anyway, or AI is going to take the widgets. So that's the problem from the designer standpoint, especially this bit of being hammered by their E&O carriers. And by the way, I work for a lot of E&O carriers, and I work for the London market. And they're focused on reducing legal risk without thinking about practical risk.
Right.
And practical risk is what you really want to focus on. So that's a hard problem for designers.
Yeah, I think one of the things that the IPD does well is the waiver of liability frees up the designers to have some input in how they understood this thing was going to be built. And they're loath to say that because of possible means and methods liability if they don't have a waiver.
They've been taught literally from the beginning that if you see a means and method, please cross the street. Get away from it. Don't even look at it.
Take another seat on the bus.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the really beneficial things. But I'm really interested in this AI thing. Maybe this is a discussion for it's probably an hour long discussion for another day. But I'm interested that fundamentally I mean, I look at the business plan of designers and I say they have four different businesses. One is the ideas of design. One is that production. One is overseeing some type of construction. And the other is business development, which some of them do very well on the widget side, but they don't do very well on the kind of the idea side. So I'm interested in that understanding of yours that they have to redirect their business plan so that they actually get paid for value and not necessarily for hours.
And you can do that to some degree if you divorce profit from cost, which is a basic thing we do in IPD.
Right.
And we say for a project like this, how much profit should an architect reasonably make? And if we set that as a set sum, now we can talk about what widgets you need and what widgets you don't need.
Right.
And they can do better.
What if we began to recognize the value of design by saying the profit you put at risk is 40%? And you're getting a multiplier of 40% on top of your hours because we want you to concentrate on those design hours. That's where you're going to really help the team. And the value there is, I mean, we just think outside of the box. We don't go, well, yeah, AIA says your standard profit is 8.5% to 12%. What if we really expanded it and said, there's a huge reward for you here?
Well, I think you can do that. And I think that, you know, to some degree, we've had some projects where, for instance, the shared savings concept or the KPI savings are more, we give the designers more of that than the percentage of their total cost. Normally that's done we focus on basically a cost over total cost percentage.
Right.
But we actually move it up for the designers so that they have a bigger stake and say in project outcome. And that that's one of the things you can do. As I said, there's a number of others, but I do think we have to, and the other one is once you set a fixed profit, then you start talking about, let's talk about what you don't need to do on this project.
Right.
You don't need to do this. You don't need to be reviewing submittals because we're not going to have very few submittals at all. We're going to basically put the RFIs into the building information model as part of the design as it comes up. We're not going to have a standard RFI process. And frankly, the working drawings are going to be developed by the trade contractors anyway.
It's funny. I was doing I was doing another version of this morning with Vince Chapman, the auditor. And he was talking about construction companies, you know, have not been able to kind of do a differentiator between themselves other than the size of their fee. And that's kind of counter to what we're trying to do in the IPD world. And the value that we were talking about there was explaining to the owner what you normally do that you won't do on this project for that very reason, that it's almost you're more valuable to us for the things you tell us you won't do.
Yeah. Now you can take that money, you can put it someplace where it's useful.
Right. So let's move to the next category, the contractors. Ever since the 60s, and this fits in with Paul Techholz's work and research in the lack of productivity in the construction industry over time. But since the 60s, we have tended to break the construction industry into smaller and smaller pieces. And we have tried to sell the risk of those smaller pieces, smaller and smaller. So on every job, you have to hire a guy who does toilet partitions. I mean, that's a specialty in construction. So the work is now done by all these specialists, and the GCs do very little, if any, work on projects. And so what's their value prop? What's the value proposition that they bring, especially in an IPD process where they aren't assuming the risk of the overall battle? They're not taking on schedule or cost risk. What's their value as a servant leader or whatever in the IPD construct? And how do they have to change the systems that they developed in that very opaque process before to this more transparent process of IPD?
Yeah. I'm not sure it's so much the systems, or maybe we're using those terms slightly differently. There are things they have to change. You've got to manage a project. I mean, when you hire a contractor, maybe you're hiring someone who happens to be a good carpenter as well. But what you're really hiring is someone who can actually manage the project. They can work. They understand site logistics. They understand dealing with supply chain. They understand how you actually have to sequence work. They understand how people have to work together. Now, this is not a hierarchical top-down approach. Now, that's one problem because traditionally that's the way they've operated.
Right.
But someone has to facilitate the conversations, manage them, pull it all together into one single project. And all those tasks remain. And in most instances, managing the cost model. Generally, the contractor knows more about that than anybody else on the project about how to overall do the cost model. Sometimes they have to go in and teach certain trade contractors how to operate in a cost-based system. Not all of them actually really know. And sometimes they have to, they may well also be providing the project-wide IT system or the project information system that will tie things together. They will be pulling in the information up the dashboard. Their basic role becomes management and facilitation and services. They become actually a central service provider to the project. And I think most of them historically have thought of themselves as captain of the ship.
Right.
Rather than the underlayment that allows it to happen. And that's a shift for some of them. We find, for instance, that some of the folks who come out of oil and gas and traditional EPC, large EPC projects, are so used to basically taking a command and control, fight for every dollar approach, they really have a hard time in collaboration.
Right.
It's a hard thing for them to do. But I think you do need those functions that I talked about for a CM. And the good CMs in this space are really focusing on a facilitative leadership approach.
So I completely agree with you. I think that the CM now, they're not really a GC anymore. They're CMs in this model for sure. And as a CM, they are a service provider. And yet they still have these archaic, I don't know if you want to call them systems, tools, approaches, whatever, that when they come to a project, they think of it as a campaign, right? So their business model says, I have a superintendent. I'm putting him or her on this project for 4 years, and I'm never going to see him again. They don't come back to the office and go to different projects. They're 4 years on this mission. And we fill up the crew and they're there for 4 years and we never want to talk to them. And we send them out there and we give them a new computer and a new phone and we charge that to the project. And, you know, they have that system. Then they have the way that they calculate their profit, which is, you know, some reasonably low fee on the entire cost of construction, regardless of whether they have IPD partners or not. And this is one of the negotiations I have with contractors all the time, is that if you're taking profit on managing the IPD partners who are also taking a profit or risk, then you're kind of doubling up on that profit when your work is really to manage the non-IPD partners, manage the entire process through your GCs, and that's what you get paid for. So I run into that all the time in actually delivering these projects. Have you seen that? How do we get GMs or big contractors to be more of a service manager, servant leader, all doing all the things that you said, being the big organizers of the campaign, the quartermaster almost?
I think you have to build, and this actually gets into some going back to some of the relational contract theory. You have to get folks like that to start thinking about. They're working with this owner again. They're working with these folks again. What is it that they can do to make this project successful? not how do they execute. And also, by the way, in some instances, you've got to toss people off the job. There's some people who have to vote off the island because they're just not going to make the shift. But
have you ever voted a GC off the island? You've ever been on a project where they have? Okay.
Yes. We also not because the architect was failing, but because the architect lost their middle management and really lost the capability of doing the project. Mm-hmm. We had to replace an architect in late DD.
Wow.
Yeah, that was painful. The project came out pretty well in the end. I can tell you when the trade contractors realized we were going to have to make this shift and it was going to cost a lot of money, they were not happy. And
that's probably an understatement for what the reaction was.
I kind of put my arms around them and said, suck it up and keep moving. You know, we got to get out of this, hole.
You shot the mule and kicked it over the bridge and the tanks kept rolling.
Yeah, and they did.
Yes, and I think that's a big challenge. I think, I'm speaking at LCI next week about what I consider generation owner, that the owner needs to be, owners in general, need to not necessarily be satisfied with the supply chain and ask for better. And I think better means bringing the right tools and the right people and the right kind of management philosophy to the job. And I think that is a huge opportunity for GCs, but it's also a huge cost. I mean, they are battleship fleets, right? They are not PT boats and small light cruisers. You know, they approach the built environment as a campaign, really.
And I don't think not all owners, I can think of one owner in Canada, by the way, that we did the first project and it went pretty well. And then they was going to do the same project. I said, well, why aren't you using the same team since they've already learned something? And the woman who runs this system said, because I need to develop a reliable supply chain. And so I want to basically have three different teams. And then I want to see how the teams perform. And I want to start developing my supply chain. I need to have I need to have a reliable supply chain to deliver my entire system. And I thought that was pretty progressive. She was willing to take some minor hits on the first couple projects in order to develop. And a lot of owners don't do that, or they don't recognize the value of their supply chain.
Right. That's a great point. I mean, I think back to CPR where we had three separate teams moving at the same time. And it was really that part of the reason for having those three teams moving at the same time was to develop capacity amongst many, but also see how they work together to figure out that, you know, where the shortfalls were, so you could really tune it up. So I do think that's really progressive. And I do think that's what owners can do, because they are the consumers of the supply chain. And if value is defined by the owner, then eventually people in the supply chain will respond to that. But right now it's difficult to get people to respond directly. So, but have you had success with GCs? And have you seen them be able to kind of move into that servant leadership where they haven't brought their entire process and have tweaked it to a collaborative construction management process?
The answer is some yes, some no. There are some that I think have made the jump. They understand it and they operate in that model particularly well. They operate with other people particularly well. You still end up in situations where you'll get one of two things. The company may understand it, but the superintendent they put in or their project executive or such just came off four low bid projects.
Right.
And that, they can't get that out of their mind. So simple answer is some yes, some no.
Okay. So it's certainly an area that we should work on developing and trying to buff up the supply chain there. With respect to the profit issue with GCs or with CMs, how do you handle that in your projects when they come to you and they say, we want 2% of all the construction costs?
Well, the way I look at that is that, what am I buying? And if 2% of construction costs, when it's calculated out into dollars,
right?
And by the way, both for Progressive Design Build and IPD, on major projects that will have a late target setting,
right?
For one reason or the other, I'm thinking about splitting, setting a profit. Well, let's just use the traditional terminology. If we're not going to set the target or the GMP until early CDs, mid CDs, or something like that,
right?
Which is like a Progressive Design Build thing, then maybe we set the profit, regardless of what the cost is, early DD. In other words,
we get it out of the way.
Well, no, to basically, not just to get it out of the way, but to say, now that you know your profit's not going to go up or down based on how much this thing's going to cost, there's no incentive for you to run the cost up.
Right. Well, that's what I mean. That's why.
Is to do target value design. Traditional Progressive Design Build, our experience is target value design doesn't work.
Right.
I think it can work. It just hasn't in a lot of Progressive Design Build projects. So that took us a little bit off the.
No, it's really interesting though, because I do think when I said set it aside, I meant get money off the table so that they're not encouraged to drive up the cost, because that is one of the things people see. I haven't seen in Progressive Design Build yet that profit has been transparent, because what I'm seeing in Progressive Design Build is I'm seeing profit is included in overhead and hourly rates.
Yeah, I'm generally not fond of having the final profit determined as a percentage of cost. At some point, you have to divorce them, and they have to be separate. And maybe overhead too in some projects. The other thing, and this is a question of how much money you've got to spend and how big the project is. But if the project's large enough, I want an accountant or a quantity survey or someone like that to vet everybody's numbers. So when we negotiate, it's going to be a very transparent negotiation. And that scares the hell out of some people.
Oh my God.
But in fact, if they can finally get to the point where they trust you, that we are not trying to make you make less profit. We're trying to make sure that profit, overhead, and cost are all in the right buckets, both so we understand them and so that they're properly set up for the right set of incentives. And that's what we're really trying to do with that early audit process. And we do that on pretty much all the big projects. We don't do small projects because you can't afford it.
That's what we started doing on every big project. And the reason that we do it and the conversation that we have once we've discovered that they're carrying things that they probably shouldn't and their hourly rates are different than what they had proposed. What I have said to owners and have negotiated on their behalf with the team is just give us a profit number that you think is fair. Don't hide it someplace. We need to be transparent about these things because we don't want you buffering or hiding it. But if it's 12%, or if it's 15%, if it's 20%, just tell us what it is. And then we can set it and we can get it going. But don't try to, put it into these numbers where transparency is supposed to be the hallmark of our trust development, right? It's the first place where you begin to trust people.
I did an IPD project probably 12, 15 maybe. Trying to remember how many years ago in Connecticut, and I said, well, okay, to the contractor and the other thing, well, what do you want for profit? And he said 0.5%. And I walked over to the window and I opened up the shades and I said, 0.5%. That's a damn nice car you're driving. And that was my only response. It's like, there's no.
Yeah.
It's the acorns. So let's see what the real numbers are.
Yeah, exactly. I call these the acorns. Nobody has ever survived on a 2% fee. You survive on the cranes, on the rental tools, on the insurance, on all this other stuff. And all we're asking, and that hasn't been immoral. I'm not saying that pejoratively. It's just the way the system has worked. That's what you had to do. And you had to do it through change orders and other things. And wouldn't it be easier if we were just open about it so we didn't have to do that?
Yeah.
That's part of my evangelism.
It takes a lot of time and effort to bury all that profit in places.
Oh, my God. And it takes people that you're paying to do that.
Let's pay you the profit and let's go straight cost.
Okay. So let's move to the trades. How do you deal with the trades? There seems to be a prevailing myth, and I've seen it in Canada probably more strongly than in the States, but regionally in the States, there's a certain bias that, well, the trades are like children. They really can't manage this project on their own. They need us because they can't be trusted.
Yeah.
That's a myth I'm trying to bust on a regular basis.
I'm not sure that they can't be trusted, but I can tell you that we've had situations when you move into smaller markets and, you know, you ask a trade contractor that normally does lump sum, and their approach to accounting is, we seem to make a profit every year. But we don't quite know how. I mean, if you ask them to explain, how do you make your money? They don't really quite understand. That does exist. Right. But on the other hand, you and I both know, and mentioned someone earlier that is with a large specialty contractor that can whip most general contractors on sophistication. I mean, there's
Candido, I think you're talking about, for sure.
I mean, there's folks out there that are
very
sophisticated, know exactly what they're doing, and much more so sometimes than the general contractor on the project. So it's pretty broad. What we have found is that obviously in major markets there are people who are sophisticated.
Right.
In smaller markets, you sometimes have to not just do an IPD education, and this is something where if you've got a really good construction manager, they can help, but you actually have to help them put together their systems and understand how they're going to make money on the project.
Right.
However, my experience also is that they're very reluctant initially, those types, because they're not sure. And they know they've made money before. They're not sure it's going to work.
Right.
But once they've actually gotten into it, they like it a lot.
Yeah. I've been in those smaller markets. The project that I did with Christian Pickell down in Jacksonville was a $9 million thing where we saved almost $800,000. We had some very small trades who were very reluctant early on and very excited at the end of the project. So is there a responsibility, do you think, of the SMACMAs and the MECAs and the NECAs and of the world and the unions to try to help smaller trade contractors understand a role in a more collaborative team?
Well, I think they should. But you know, with regard to I did a PLA. Put a PLA together for project labor agreement with labor unions for those who don't do labor work. And initially, and we were talking about, for instance, joint trades operating and creating joint work product, how you handle that and such. And
right.
The initial response, of course, for a lot of them is, well, that's ours. That's our work. Nobody else can touch that. And
right.
We slowly were able to get them to understand that if that's really where you're going, then you're basically going to tell everyone to do that as modular work. And so if you want to protect your members, we need to figure out how we work together and how we figure out collaboratively what the appropriate sections are. And we got there. We've got a PLA, which is actually pretty successful.
And we were, I was working on a project in Chicago where we had that issue. It became a jurisdictional issue for common trade racking. We were trying to get everybody over into the plumber shop and put all your stuff in the 60-foot long racks that we were going to put up. And there was a ton of jurisdictional issues. And we got around that by getting the unions, four big unions that were involved, including the steam pipe guys, to call this a pilot program. So yeah. That they weren't, you know, they weren't negotiating themselves into a position where there was precedent here. They just called it a pilot program. So, all right. So in the few minutes we have left, let's get to the big elephant in the room, the big elephant on the march, the guys that got us over the Pyrenees to get after the Romans, the owners. You work with owners all the time. You've been on owners' councils. You've been in Victor Sanvito's private owners' circle workshops. What are two or three things, or four, however many you have, that owners can do right now to try to both open themselves up to these kinds of contracts and work on the supply chain to make the right people available to them?
Well, owners have to go up, down, and sideways.
Okay.
Up, they have to make sure that there's adequate support at a senior level, whatever that means inside their organization. A couple of owners that have had some highly successful projects have failed to create the systems to continue to do that, because at some point in time, senior leadership doesn't really support it. And if people get the sense that senior leadership is going to bolt the moment something goes wrong, then no one will make any change at all. A very interesting thing, and this was Maine General, the fellow who headed up the entire system said, sent some people out to decide what project delivery method to use. He said, here's what we've learned. He chose IPD. And they started down the road, and there were some problems with financing. There were some problems with weather. And he said, we're not changing. This is what we're doing. We're executing all the way to the end. And once he did that, he freed up everybody to execute there. So that's the up.
They brought in the necessary resources that they needed. I remember Bill Stevens from Robbins and Morton was on that project, I think.
Yeah.
You know, up from Birmingham to Maine, that was quite an awakening for him.
Yeah, I mean, they worked with a local contractor, and I said, the only thing you guys have in common is you both have accents. They just happen to be totally different. but that's the upside. As I said, the downside is they have to be very clear with their supply chain as to what they want and why they want it. And once owners have made that clear, the supply chain generally reacts. Sometimes the supply chain says, I don't want to do this, but I damn well want the job. Some of those people you have to filter out, but some of them actually end up being pretty good when you get there. But the owners have to focus on the supply chain. The second, the sideways is a lot of owners, unless they are serial builders, which sort of sounds like a crime, unless they're serial builders, they do not have internal capacity to manage their own projects. And that puts them in a very awkward position. And it usually means that their historic position has been to assume that everyone's cheating on them, and right, they have to watch out for it because they can't participate. They don't have the people power to participate. And that's a problem for an owner that does a lot of work. So if they don't have that, they've got to find a truly trusted, confident that can work with them and to provide the capability that they don't have. And for builders who build every once in a while, owners who build every once in a while, that's what they have to do. For builders that build constantly, they should have their own internal team. And that internal team has to have very clear direction from the up, from the senior folks. They have to know that someone's got their back. And then they're in a position where they can start actually making decisions and execute. So owners have to transform. You mentioned pilot. In some instances, if it's a really large organization, they can't make all those changes instantaneously for one project. And so they're better off pulling out a group and say, you're going to run these a couple projects here as a pilot. And then we're going to see whether or not we roll it out for the rest of the firm. But owners have immense power, but they have to commit and use it.
I agree. I'm going to try to get them energized in Detroit. Will we see you at LCI?
We will see me at LCI. I will get there on Tuesday evening.
Oh, fantastic. Well, this has been terrific. Thank you for taking the time to do it. I'd love to come back and visit with you and maybe Stan Chu on what does AI mean for the construction industry? As I think you both have probably really well-developed ideas about a tsunami that might be coming down the pike that we might be thinking about. So if you're willing to do that, I'd love to have you back.
Sure. It's interesting. You also might love, Phil Bernstein's got a book out, by the way, which is also directly on the subject by the Royal Institute of British Architects.
That's a great idea. Yeah, Phil's a good guy. And now that he's doing more teaching and less autodesking, he's making a real splash out there. So,
yeah,
good point.
Thank you for tuning in to the Lean Construction Blogs podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word by sharing, subscribing, or leaving a review on your preferred podcast listening platform. Remember to join us next time as we continue to lower the barriers to applying lean construction and help take your lean journey to the next level. And don't forget to visit the Lean Construction blog to stay up to date on our latest podcast episodes, weekly blog posts, monthly webinars, and upcoming conferences. We hope to see you on the next episode.